cooking your lunch every day can be time-consuming, but eating out gets really expensive. We're talking about how to pack a healthy, affordable lunch on the morning show. A couple of stats from a Visa survey a few years back. Americans spend an average of $20 a week eating out for lunch, and that adds up to more than $1,000 a year. What do you make that keeps you going past that late afternoon lull? What's a key part of your lunch that you can't go without? We're at 800-642-1234 to join the conversation. Samantha Golub is a registered dietitian with UW Health. Samantha, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So why do you think packing a lunch is so important?
It's vital. I really think that packing a lunch is important because it helps us to control what we're putting into our body. It helps us control, you know, not only the health of our food, hopefully it's healthier than what we would get at fast food or out to eat for lunch, but, you know, it's less expensive, like you were saying, and It helps us to fuel our body when we need it instead of waiting in line at the fast food.
So what are the components of a healthy yet filling lunch that you can pack?
Filling is important. We really don't want to go hungry when we're not eating for several hours in the afternoon. So fueling our body with things like proteins. So something that's going to really sustain us for a few hours, fiber-rich foods like whole grains, fruits, and vegetables, and then healthy fats are important too to keep us going.
So it sounds like a mix of things. Why is protein so important to have in your lunch bag?
Yeah, so protein takes a long time for our bodies to digest, so it keeps us satisfied for about 3 or 4 hours, which is great. It fuels our muscles, it fuels our brains, so getting that source of fuel in our body is great to really just keep us going throughout the afternoon.
What about carbohydrates? Because those can get really tricky. Those can make you want to fall asleep.
Yes, exactly. If we're not getting the right kind of carbohydrates throughout the day, it is going to make us crash in the afternoon. So there are different types of carbohydrates. We really want to focus on the fiber-rich ones. So fruits and vegetables and whole grains versus the refined carbohydrates like the pastries and the sugary foods and the candy bars.
So what is a classic easy lunch that you recommend people pack and that really hits all of these targets?
That's a great question. So typically I recommend just a whole grain sandwich, something with maybe a peanut butter and jelly, egg salad, just a deli meat sandwich, having some dipping veggies on the side and a piece of fruit. Really covers all of your bases.
All right. Well, I've actually brought my, I pack my lunch like 90% of the time. And I was telling my coworkers, I probably should put some skin in here because I'm going to open up my lunch. I'm going to get it off the floor. All right. So this is really embarrassing because you're going to see all my vices and this is bad. But I'm unpacking it here. And so this sandwich you talked about, this multigrain sandwich, I hit the mark here. But the thing is, the bread these days is so big that I have two huge large sandwiches. This is turkey and Swiss. And lots of baby arugula on there in this really nutty multigrain bread.
Looks delicious.
So I think that will work, although I might have to give half to my office mate, Rob Ferret.
or save some for snacks later.
That actually is a great idea, save for snack. So things are going well. I've got a piece of fruit, a banana, and an apple. Hopefully those will be digested and eaten.
Yes.
And then things go kind of down the drain because I do like chips.
That's great.
I really like chocolate. So I've got my Monster mix.
It's good to have a little snack in there, something that you're really looking forward to. And you've got whole grain chips, so that's a good choice.
Some chips. Yep. Yeah. So, but, you know, what about there's this other thing and the soda. Yeah, the soda that I was going to like leave it at my desk and then I thought, you know, I really got to fess up. How do you stop drinking soda?
Oh, that's a great question. Soda is something that I think our country really struggles with, and I see it all of the time with my patients. It's a hard thing to go off of, so finding a replacement, you know, a lot of people are turning to sparkling waters, mm-hmm. which are really readily available, so that might be a good way just to get that carbonation, but hydrate instead of dehydrate, and then watching that sugar too. So there's nothing that we really know is wrong with diet sodas right now. So that would be an okay replacement, just to get rid of those sugars that are really
a lot of sugar.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Might make you crash in the afternoon.
Well, you know, we just one step at a time.
One step at a time. Exactly.
We're gathering tips for packing nutritious and affordable lunches for school and work with Samantha Gollop at our side. She's a registered dietitian with UW Health. What snacks do you pack that leave you feeling satisfied? What question do you have for our dietitian? What's your go-to sandwich, and how have you figured out how to get your kids to branch out from PB&J? We're at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the brown bag discussion right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about ways to pack better lunches and snacks for work and school here on The Morning Show. It takes time and planning, but there are benefits to your health and your budget. A deli sandwich averages about $6, but you could make that same sandwich at home for $2. What do you pack in your lunch that keeps you going through the day? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Samantha Gollop stays with us. She is a registered dietitian with UW Health. Samantha, what about snacks? How important are they in keeping us from being super hungry when we get home from a long day and just like opening up that pantry and going to town?
Yeah, that's a great question. I know for me, I start my day pretty early, as you guys do too. Mm-hmm. So I get hungry by like 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning. Yes. And if I were to have to wait until lunch, I would be ravenous. I wouldn't want what I've really packed in my lunch. I'd want something that's quick, fast, and really filling. So I think snacks are a really important thing to pack in your lunches. Maybe one for the morning and one in the afternoon. I really like to have a snack right at the end of my day before I go home so that I can really make myself a healthy dinner instead of going to the pantry right away and getting those snacky foods.
What are some great snacks to bring along?
That's a great question. So we talked about proteins and carbohydrates. So those are two really great things to put into your lunch for snack time. So thinking like a string cheese and a piece of fruit is a great option. Mm-hmm. You get that salty and that sweet, which is nice. You could do some egg salad and crackers.
Hummus
and veggies.
Hummus and carrots. Yes. That's like one of my favorite snacks.
Great. There you go. That makes up for that soda.
A lot of people around here go around with their salads. They make, you know, big salads in a bowl. And then they, how do salads work for packing?
That's a good question too, because, you know, we think that salads are really healthy because they're filling us up and giving us those veggies, but salads can actually be not enough sometimes because we're not adding all of the proper ingredients. So again, having a protein source with it is going to help keep you full. If we're just doing veggies, probably not going to be enough calories. It's something we're going to use really quickly. And then healthy fats too. So adding nuts or seeds or avocado, and then a healthy dressing that you maybe make at home or get in the refrigerated section at the grocery store.
Sometimes I think the biggest obstacle to packing a lunch is having the right plastic Tupperware, the stuff. Like, I can't find a lid for this, and it's taking me 5 minutes to find a lid for it's exactly the right size, but I can't find the lid. And so I think organization is huge.
It is. And that's something that my husband gets on me a lot, too, about the Tupperware. We have a shelf full of Tupperware. But having stuff that you like to use and that you can keep organized, things that are stackable, I prefer getting glass Tupperware with the locking lids, because that's nice if you're going to bring soups to lunch or something that you need to heat up. So, yeah, that that's a great component to packing lunches.
And when you're planning your week out and heading to the grocery store, how do you plan that and keep that in mind in terms of what you're going to pack for the week and really stick with it? Because you can get to midweek and you're like, okay, I'm out of this.
Yes.
Or I'm out of one single ingredient, therefore I'm done.
Right, right. Yeah, it can be kind of degrading. So planning a couple of days that you're going to go to the grocery store, it's not worth it to go every single day, but at least once or twice a week to go to the grocery store to get those things that you need. Planning ahead, you know, knowing if you're going to have lunch brought in or if you're going to be going out for lunch with coworkers, but really just planning ahead so that you're not overbuying too, because I think we really get into that waste habit as well.
What about dinner options, like taking last night's dinner? What do you think about that?
Leftovers are fantastic. So that's actually what I have for lunch today, is leftovers from last night. Leftovers are great, and usually we spend more time on our dinners too, so you know, doing a double meal prep of dinner would be great, just so that you have the next couple days of lunch ready to go.
Yeah, and sometimes it's like holding back your family. Yes. Like, hey, don't eat another serving. I'm going to take that for lunch.
Yeah, exactly. I'll have some patients actually put it away before they even start eating so that they aren't tempted to go back for seconds if they are feeling really hungry.
And just very quickly, some people struggle to put food on the table. Mm-hmm. What would you say is really economical in terms of a low-cost lunch?
That's a great question. So having an economical lunch is really important. Doing a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, some baby carrots, and a piece of in-season fruit is going to be your best bet.
Well, thank you so much, Samantha.
Yeah, thank you.
Samantha Gollop is a registered dietitian with UW Health. A couple of resources she has for us, foodandnutrition.org and eatright.org. You can find those links on the morning show page at WPR.org. Coming up, we're talking about Wisconsin honey production. News is next. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking with this year's American Honey Queen about honey production and the needs of bees and beekeepers. But first, let's take a moment to get updated on our sweet spring membership drive. It is the Wisconsin Public Radio Spring Membership Drive, and I'm Kate Archer-Kent here with Noah Ovshinsky. Good morning.
Good morning. It is good to be here.
And as a WPR listener, you know you're always going to hear something interesting when you tune in. And that's thanks to your support. It's listeners who provide the largest share of funding for WPR programs. When you give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552, you make the morning show, you make everything else you hear in WPR possible.
And Kate, we've got about 25 minutes left this hour and looking to get 8 more pledges in the door. So your gift right now is so very important, because when you give, you support the programs you rely on every day.
Awesome. And so thank you so much if you've already given. If you haven't, the time is now. Give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And in the last segment, we learned about power lunches. I got to take a sneak peek at Kate's lunch.
Better or for worse. Yeah,
no, it was very good. It's a lot better than mine. But a fascinating conversation about the kinds of things we should be eating and maybe should not be eating for lunch, and what kinds of things go a long way in helping sort of calm our appetite. Very cool segment. I learned a lot. Also feeling a bit guilty coming out of it, but I certainly learned a lot. You know, these are the kinds of conversations you count on from the morning show.
WPR is listener powered. It's listener supported. And that means that your donation at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. It makes the many topics that you tune in for every day possible. So choose an amount that works for you, then make your gift.
This membership drive, we have an exciting drawing for a $500 grocery gift card. You'll have 5 chances to win. No contribution is necessary. You can see all the rules at WPR.org. Better yet, you can be automatically entered when you make a donation of any amount right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You have a lot of bills in your monthly budget that are out of your control.
Certainly my education, but hopefully it's going to be worth it and going towards a good cause.
Rent, for sure.
Every time I turn around, my automobile insurance is increasing.
Unlike the other things you pay for, you're always in control of your sustaining membership. During this pledge drive, we ask our sustainers to consider an increase to your monthly gift. How about $5 a month? It'll go a long way to pay for the WPR programs you rely on day in and day out. Thank you for your ongoing support.
Go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552 to make your donation in support of the programs that you count on. I'm Kate Archer-Kent here with Noah Ovshinsky. Your support today of Wisconsin Public Radio keeps all the programs that you enjoy going strong. And whether your contribution is $10 a month, whether it's $100 a month, we appreciate and we truly count on your gift.
Everyone should make the gift that works for them. And for you, that might be a gift of $1 or $200 a month.
Maybe that's what you pay for cable or your family's phone plan. Listening to WPR is something you do every day, so put a value on it, like other things that are important to you, at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Kate, we've got just about 22 minutes left this hour, and we're looking for 8 more people to join in. You make WPR possible and help us stay on track with your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And as an added bonus for supporting the programs that you love, your donation enters you into a drawing for a $500 grocery gift card. So fabulous, so practical. You'll have 5 chances to win. So give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And sustainers, those of you making those ongoing monthly gifts, thank you. And you are automatically entered.
And if you're not a sustainer, you can become one right now. It's easy to set up and you'll make ongoing monthly donations from your bank account or credit card at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 to provide reliable support for the programs you love.
Thank you so much for your support and doing what you can for Wisconsin Public Radio. More than a decade after we learned about colony collapse disorder, people are still worried about honeybees, and there's good reason for that. We're talking about bees and honey production here on The Morning Show. Beekeepers still lose a substantial portion of their honeybee colonies each year, and last winter, an estimated 30% of managed colonies in the U.S. were lost. What do you want to know about honeybees? What do you do to prepare your hives? Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Hannah Schustrom is the American Honey Queen. She represents the American Beekeeping Federation, and she was the 2018 Wisconsin Honey Queen, which is a program that is run by the Wisconsin Honey Producers Association, and she joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hannah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So you're a third generation beekeeper. How many hives do you and your family run?
We currently run about 200 hives. And growing up in the industry, I guess I just loved beekeeping because I was always intrigued in how important they are in our lifestyle.
So what were your chores growing up in terms of the bees?
I would always go out to the hives with my dad. And then if we weren't in the bee yards working with our bees, it was bottling honey and preparing for the market.
What about getting stung? Did you get stung?
I mean, you always have to get stung with honeybees, but they are very docile creatures and will only sting if they have to.
So what kind of work does beekeeping involve? Can you take us through the process?
Absolutely. So in the spring of the year, you'll have either packages bees come in, and so those will be your brand new bees that will come from California or Georgia, and then you're going to put those into the hive. Some people around this time of the year are also going to be bringing their bees back from California or other southern states because they are going to be what we call migratory beekeepers. There are lots of pollination needs across the country, and so they will move their bees from area to area pollinating the crops that are in need.
Oh, wow. So it's like you can see the movement, like just crops coming alive as you go straight across the country.
Yes. And so like right now they're in California pollinating or just they're going to get done pollinating the almond crops. And then they're going to move up to Washington for the apple blossoms. Mm. And then pretty soon it'll be summer here in Wisconsin and we'll be pollinating the cranberry bogs.
So as you look at your family's work and the work that you're doing in terms of beekeeping, where are we at with colony collapse disorder and the health of our bees in the United States?
We are still every year losing about 1/3 of our honeybee population, and that is going to be unintentional losses that we don't want. And so we have researchers and scientists are working along together with the beekeepers, trying to figure out what is happening exactly. And one thing they've found so far is that it's not just one thing affecting the bee health, but multiple factors all at once. And so using that knowledge, one huge thing we're trying to focus on right now is kind of increasing the floral sources for the bees to kind of increase the diversity in their diet.
In the northern U.S., we had the temperatures drop really, really low, the polar vortex. So what do beekeepers do to prepare for winter? And can you prepare for something like this?
You can always try to prepare for it, that's for sure. One thing some beekeepers will do is in October, November, they will wrap their colonies. And so you can either do like a black tar paper that you'll wrap the colonies in to kind of insulate it. Or some other beekeepers will also take things like cardboard. It's just kind of trying to add that little extra protection for the winter. Because the honeybees can normally survive the cold temperatures because they will keep their hive at a constant 98 degrees all throughout the winter. They just don't love the fluctuation in the temperatures because then they can't always mediate the temperature as well.
So what do we need to be aware of to prevent hive loss? And is hive loss a real thing when it comes to these devastatingly cold winters?
It is for sure. Yes, it is a real thing that affects many of our beekeepers here. And if, like, now that we're starting to go into spring, like you said, trying to improve the health of the bees, one thing that people can do that's really easy is if they can just leave the dandelions in their yard. I know they're not the prettiest things to look at all the time, but it is going to be one of the first floral sources for the bees. And it's crucial in getting that hive off to a good start after that cold, harsh winter.
We're talking with Hannah Schustrom. She's a third-generation beekeeper from Maiden Rock and the 2019 American Honey Queen. Beekeepers, what are you looking forward to or worried about this year? We're at 800-642-1234 is the number to join the conversation. Hannah, help us understand, what are the impact of bees? Why do we need these bees?
We need our lovely honeybees because about 1/3 of the food we eat requires pollination, with 80% of that dependent on the honeybees. And so a lot of those food sources, the quality and the quantity is driven by the honeybees and their pollination efforts.
What is the life of a bee like? Can you walk us through the bee's timeline and their life with us?
Sure. And so in the summer, the bees are going to be out flying so much that they'll only live for about 4 to 6 weeks. So they have a very short time to make a big impact. And at the start of their life, they will actually be nurse bees. They will be caring for the other young bees. And then they will also move throughout their life. They will be making wax. They will also guard the hive. They are going to care for the queen. And then at the very end of their life is when they will go and forage for honey.
So they have a very intense but short life.
They do. And then while honeybees are mostly known for all the honey that they make, that little honeybee will only produce 1/12 of a teaspoon of honey in her lifetime.
Oh, my goodness. You talk to beekeepers around the country. What are some of their top concerns when it comes to protecting the health of our honeybees?
A huge concern all across the United States right now is just kind of controlling the mites. And that's kind of going to be like a tick on the bee, but it's going to carry multiple diseases. And so we are really worried about that, and then also focusing a lot on floral sources all across the United States. Those are things that beekeepers can agree on that need to be focused on to help improve the health of the honeybees.
Well, let's bring in a call now. Let's go to Kate in Barneveld. Hi, Kate.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My son is a first-time beekeeper as of last year, and I have a question kind of on his behalf. About better chances of wintering over, and also then some resources that he can turn to as a young beekeeper. His hives, he only has one hive set up with two deeps and then the shallow. We did wrap his hive with a blanket, like a quilt, rather than tar paper, because we did this kind of last minute when we realized it was going to get so bitter cold. The hive is in a protected area. The bees, by the sound of it, did survive that most bitter cold snap that we had, but then seemed to die within maybe 4 days or so after that. So that's the situation with that.
Kate, let's get some reaction from Hannah. What about a rookie beekeeper and how they approach this winter?
Absolutely. So if you're looking as a beginner beekeeper on some wonderful resources that can help you kind of start to or learn more about beekeeping and all the things you didn't really know you needed to know, a wonderful resource is going to get connected with your county clubs. And then there's also going to be a state and federal organizations for the beekeeping industry. And so those are going to be great organizations where they can give you resources you need. And you can also interact with beekeepers one-on-one. And so another thing, like walking into winter, just to kind of, it's always going to be kind of dependent on the winter and how the bees are doing. And so you can just try to feed your bees, make sure they have enough food going into the winter, and then also make sure that you've been taking care of the mite population, and also just kind of like wrap them or do other things to prepare them for the winter.
And we have a links to the state's honey organization and the American Beekeeping Federation at WPR.org on the morning show page. Kate, thanks so much for the call. You know, you're talking, Hannah, about dandelions. Are there things we should or shouldn't plant when it comes to helping bees?
If you just want to start planting floral sources that the bees love, that's always going to be good. They really need different floral sources in their diet because right now they kind of have a lot of the same floral sources around. And so they're kind of like humans where it's like we can't just eat one food source and be able to be healthy off of it. So we're just trying to really increase the diversity of the floral sources that are planted and try and help improve the health of the honeybees that way.
You were recently at the University of Florida Southern Bee Lab as part of your work. What were you doing there? What did you learn?
I was just there, whereas I grew up here in the northern industry, the beekeeping climate in the southern industry is going to be completely different. And so I was there just personally learning more about how the southern industry is completely different. Whereas up here, we have to prepare our bees for winter. They were talking a lot about how do they help the bees survive through hurricanes or all the swampy weather that they have down there.
Oh, and all the water as well, just even rising water. And what do you do about those hives? Mm-hmm. Because they can get lost so quickly. I've certainly seen that. So as the American Honey Queen, what does your work involve?
I get to travel the wonderful United States this next year as a national representative promoting the industry. So I'll be at events like government visits, to school presentations, to media interviews. So anything involving the honey industry where we can get word out about that is where we're going to be all year long.
And prior to this role, you were the Wisconsin Honey Queen. What is Wisconsin's honey industry like?
Wisconsin honey industry is going to be, it's very diverse with our beekeepers. It's going to be about 3 million pounds of honey that is produced by Wisconsin. So we're currently ranked at the 15th out of the entire states for honey production. And a lot of things that need pollination around us are going to be like the cranberries or apple trees. And so Wisconsin has lots of different varieties of things that need to be pollinated by the honeybees.
As we wrap up here, what would you say to someone who's interested in trying beekeeping for the first time?
I would encourage them to try beekeeping, but really encourage the fact that they should get in touch with local communities, whether it's a county club or a state and federal organizations, because they're going to have wonderful resources for them to reach out to. And a lot of times they will also have mentor programs where they will walk the beekeeper through the first year of beekeeping and give them the hands-on experience, but also the help that they might need.
Well, Hannah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Hannah Schustrom is American Honey, the American Honey Queen. She represents the American Beekeeping Federation, and she joined us from our studios in Eau Claire. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We've been talking about our pollinator friends here on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.